welcome. This is Cliff calling you from a rainy Oakland, California. It's Saturday, March 29th, and there's a lot happening archaeologically, a lot happening discovery-wise, and this is what Earth Ancients is all about. Most of you are coming to this program via Facebook. There could be some that are word of mouth, but the Facebook page is an international page that I launched a couple of years ago. Just to post the news out there, a lot of my research, which is over 20 years, and that the research and the writings and the articles from a number of noted authors, researchers, and investigators who I find are really cutting edge. On the news front, I have posted a couple of articles by an engineer, James O'Conn, who wrote a book called The Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology. And what is happening in the world of archaeology is more that they focus on an interdisciplinary approach to their work, interdisciplinary being bringing in engineers, bringing in biologists, bringing in other forms of science. The greater the discovery and also our knowledge is grown. And what O'Conn was able to discover over the years, I think he spent like 5 to 7 years in the jungles of the Yucatan. And by the way, we're going to have O'Conn on our program in a couple of weeks, so stay tuned for that. But what he discovered was an amazing level of technology, engineering, and science behind not only the structures, the buildings that the Maya put together, but the way they ran their civilizations. In other words, I posted a photograph of Palenque, which is in Chiapas, Mexico, and he actually found a very sophisticated aqueduct, an underground water collection system that during the rainy season not only collected the water but also distributed the water throughout miles of underground water channels and reservoirs. And it's just fascinating. What is perhaps one of the most interesting finds is his discovery of a water purification system that is now thought to be found at most of the major cities throughout Yucatan. I don't know. He'll have to discuss it when we have him on, but I don't know if it's at all the cities, but apparently most of the major cities had a water purification system which actually treated the water before it was drinkable. And I've posted some photographs on that on the Facebook page, and you can read about it. So it's quite fascinating. Look for water treatment of the ancient Mayas. That's the posting. And have a look at those photographs. Today's guest, we'll have him on in a second, is Jan Pieter de Jong, who is a Dutch researcher. And he's going to talk about three periods in ancient Earth culture as it relates to stonework. And he has been studying stonework for over a decade, and this interview is going to be quite interesting. I just posted some photographs that are supporting this interview, and you can find Hanan Pacha, Urin Pacha, Urkin Pacha styles of rock work or building technology on the Facebook page, and it relates to this this interview. Those are the three periods he'll be talking about, and I'm discussing them real quickly because that's the basis of his work, and it's actually quite fascinating. We're gonna start this in a minute, so we'll start the interview in a minute. On other notes, I brought up last week that the archives for these shows are now on iTunes, and I've made them free. and you can go and download them directly, or you can just listen to them. If you have a machine, if you have a device, they're available online. So that should make it easier to listen to. Also, Blog Talk Radio, you can go directly to that that link and listen to each of the episodes. So here is the interview that I did with Peter DeJong, and I hope you like it.
So my next guest is Jan Peter DeJong, who is a Dutch research investigator, author, and producer. An agricultural engineer by profession, in the early 1990s he worked on an irrigation project high in the Andes of Ecuador, and later developed an interest in the South American countries he visited. He has spent over a decade of in-depth study of the ruins of Cusco and the surrounding regions. He developed an interest in the buildings of the Inca capital, Cusco, and Sacsayhuaman, and later discovered the work of Alfredo Gamarra. Gamarra, through his own research, had concluded years earlier that three distinctly different civilizations had contributed to the construction of many of the ancient buildings, walls, and other structures which archaeologists attributed to the Inca. Jan would later use these three-world hypothesis to develop a unique video called The Cosmogony of the Three Worlds, a documentary on Gamarra's research as exemplified in the buildings of these ancient people. Jan has embraced the three-world theory and has concluded that many other ancient cities throughout the world use a similar science in their stonework and building techniques. Jan is also the author and producer of Eti Men Akini, and also Evidence of Vitrified Stonework of Inca Sites. Welcome to the program, Jan. Glad to have you with us.
Hi, Cliff. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here.
Great. So, you and I have communicated back and forth for a few years now, and your work is quite fascinating to me. Let's kind of go back a little bit. You are in the Netherlands. Tell me why you developed an interest in South America. You did irrigation work in Ecuador, but why? I mean, that's halfway across the world. What was your interest?
Yeah. Well, my interest for the first time I went there, it was for the profession that I was studying at that time, and it was agriculture. And as you might know, the potato is like a very important crop in Holland, but the potato originally comes from the Andes. So what I did was, the first time I went to Peru was to do practice for my studies. And I visited the International Potato Center, and I was there like 4 months doing practice, investigating with some professionals there on the potato and how it could adapt to the other places in Peru. Mm. So agriculture basically was the most important thing that let me go to South America in the first place. Mm-hmm. And after I finished my studies, like at the end of the 80s, I went a few times more, and I wanted to go there, and I wanted to work in Peru and in Cusco, where I also went for a part of my practice to an irrigation project, a Dutch project at that time. But it was a pity that at that time there was a terrorism organization, the Shining Path. You might have heard about it, and well, it wasn't possible to stay there, so I went back to Holland, and then later I got a job to go to Ecuador for a 3 years contract, and it was an irrigation project also in the Andes. But after that time, speaking about mid-90s, I went to Peru again, into Cusco, which I already knew from the first time I went to Peru for my practice. And I started working in tourism. I got my own companies there, a travel agency, a restaurant, and a pub. And, at the same time, I met Gamarra, Jesus Gamarra. And he started showing me around of about all the Inca sites and telling me his interpretations, and I really got very interested in all that he had to tell him. And from that time, I really started studying and seeing more, because if you're there the first time and you see all those walls and yeah, it's amazing, no? But there's stones and stones and stones, but Gamara was really the person who showed me the differences and how all the sites are built like layers on layers, different layers, and that he said the first layer was at that time, then there was a second layer that was later, and then the third layer that was from the Incas or Inca time.
Mm-hmm.
So what we see there, it's against the normal way of thinking that all the sites there are Inca and that the best styles, the most sophisticated stonework is from the last part of the Inca period. But that's not true. I don't believe in that anymore, but really Gamara was the person that made me see that. And if you go there with him, and you go to Sacsayhuamán, and you go to Pisac, and to Machu Picchu, and all the other sites around Cusco,
mm-hmm.
then it's really amazing how all the things he's talking about are repeated in all those sites.
Well, let's go back to the beginning a little bit. So you were somewhat of a tourist when you met Gamara, Jesús Gamara, and so what piqued your interest? What developed... What inside you inspired you to take it to the next level and become a researcher?
I wasn't really a tourist. I was already working when I met Gamara. I had my companies in Cusco. I was living in Cusco.
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed to do, after his father died, Jesus got more motivated to bring the work out. So to say, he wanted to do more and tell the world about it, and that is when he wanted to do a documentary, and he asked me if I would like to do it with him. And at that time, I was one of the first that was making CDs. You know, it was at that time the first time that you could record your own CDs, and that there was a digital video. Of course, at the starting point of digital editing, and I'm talking about mid-90s, and at that time I was one of the first doing those things in Cusco.
Okay.
And we agreed to do the documentary, and it was quite a long process, and in the process I learned a lot from him, and we went visiting all the important sites, and it was also the time that internet was coming in Cusco, and we could see things on the internet and compare stonework of Cusco with stonework in other places.
Okay.
Of course, Jesus already knew that there were places like Egypt, Malta, places that we also talk about in our documentary.
Okay.
That have similar stonework, and it's really amazing. It's still almost daily I see on the internet or on Facebook in the different groups, I see pictures passing by that of which I say that's the same style as in Cusco. It's the same stonework, and
okay.
It's very surprising and amazing that in all parts of the world you see the same things repeated.
So why don't you explain for our audience Gamara's theory of the three worlds and how it relates to the construction techniques, just without going into, because there's a lot that he describes, but describe the three worlds.
Yeah, the three worlds of Gamara are three different periods in time who can be related to the three different styles that one can see at the Inca sites and also on world level. The first style, or the oldest style that he's talking about, is the Hanan Pacha style, as he calls it. And Hanan Pacha means the heaven, practically. No, it was paradise, the time of paradise on earth, according to him. And at that time, people were able to mold like rocks, like whole rocks, like whole mountains, even on a very big scale. And it's the style that you see in the center of the Inca sites or below the other styles. And it's the same mountain that was like adapted by people, like molded, as he says it, because it looks like that those stones have been soft. They were able to work on it like clay. And that is what we call the Hanampacha style. It's the base of the Inca sites. You see that also in other parts of the world, like in Malta, where we have the Hippogeum, and that's made also in stone, in one piece of stone. You can see it in Egypt, where the subterranean chamber of the Great Pyramid is made in one piece of stone, because the Great Pyramid is made above a rock, you know, a big rock. And inside that rock there is the subterranean chamber. Another one is, for example, in Jerusalem. There are many examples all over the world that Gamara relates to that Hanampacha time, the first time, the first period of mankind, when the whole earth was paradise. That's one style, and many ancient sites all over the world are made over that style, like respecting it, like protecting it also. That's how we could interpret it. And,
you're actually saying that the Hanampacha style is the original style, and then subsequent or later generations cover it or work around it because it's cherished. It's the original. It's recognized by later generations or later people as the sacred stones. And so,
exactly. They are sacred. Yeah. Sacred stones. It's a sacred. It has been a time that people treat with respect, because it was the time of the gods, the time of the heroes, and the time of the first time of men. And in our memories, there are heroes and gods from that time that we speak about, and the religions speak about it in their books, the Bible, for Gamara, the first time of mankind was paradise on earth, till God threw us out of paradise. How do you say that? He threw us out of paradise, yes. So till that time it was the whole earth's paradise, and then there was a big change that also affected the way they could build in stone. According to Gamara, that was because stone was less dense in the beginning time. It would have been less dense because gravity was less. And then there was a big change that Earth went from one orbit to another orbit, further away from the Sun. And at the same time, it also acquired more mass. That means that Earth, from one moment to the other, increased in mass and gravity also. The earth became bigger, and it meant that instead of people being very big and also being capable of living almost eternally, they then went to another period in which they couldn't live that long anymore, but still like hundreds of years or maybe 1,000 years. And at the same time, in that new period, the construction style had to change. They were able to make stones still on a very big scale. Then I'm talking about the second style, and that second style are blocks of stone that fit perfectly and could be on a very big scale, like we see in Sacsayhuamán.
So you're talking about Hanampacha.
That is what he calls the Hanampacha time.
Okay.
Yes.
Listen, before we go to Hanampacha, let me ask you a few more questions about Hanampacha, because that is the most unique. So, what is the time frame that Gamara gives, approximate time frame for that period in Earth's history? Is it 100,000 years ago?
Yeah, that's more or less 100,000 years ago till like 60, 70, 80,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was the first period.
Okay.
That is based on what he heard about the ice ages, and also based on some calculations on what the Bible says about how long people could live.
Right.
So he takes the what the Bible mentions, and also like what they mention in Egyptian cultures, that people could live very long. He takes it literally. He doesn't calculate to make it to an age that is acceptable for our time, you know.
Yeah.
Because others say, well, they must have been mentioning that it were months or. There were no years or something like that. No, he took it for real, and then he comes to these calculations, and it more or less also coincides with the ice ages. He says when there was an orbit change, we entered in an ice age, mm-hmm. because we went further away from the sun. It was colder for a long time, and Earth had to readapt, and the climate had to develop again and become warmer again. And mm-hmm. Then, those are considerations he made about the different time frames. And the second period of the Urampacha would have been like till some 30,000 years ago.
So from some 80 to the 30,000
would have been the Urampacha. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's finish up with Hanapacha. What did Gomara think was the cause of the Earth being pushed away from the sun? Because according to the theory, his theory is that the Earth was closer to the sun, and the gravity was different. So, what would be the cause? What was the change that pushed the Earth away?
You have to understand that his father, Alfredo. He was Catholic, and he tried to make coincidence with religion and what he learned and what his own investigations made it clear to him. So he said it was a decision of God. God made it happen that we were thrown out of paradise. So
okay. The
decision was from God. I've always been discussing this with Jesus. Is that a good thing to say? Because, yeah, it's very easy to say. God did it, you know.
And, yeah. It's a good excuse, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that Jesus and Alfredo, they are very serious about their investigations. They have really great insights and all the principles and the whole theory is, if you go there and you go to see the site and he explains it to you, there's so much logic in it. And from that point I started investigating myself deeper and deeper, and then I came to interesting theories like the expanding Earth theory or the electric universe theory, where I saw things that really could explain it further. Because if you go to the expanding Earth theory, it says that the Earth was smaller in the past, and that there was less gravity, and it is an explanation about the huge size of dinosaurs, for example. But not only dinosaurs, all kinds of life, including plants and animals, was bigger in the past. Of the same type of lifestyles we have now, there were bigger examples in the past. So why not humans, you know? And you also know, you are very, how you say, you're doing a lot of research also.
Yes.
In what's ancient mystery. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people say there were giants in the past, and there are even evidences that they really existed.
Skeletons
in the United States.
Yeah,
and
there's a lot of skeletons that are there. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You have a continue your thought, and I'll have.
Thanks to the internet, you know, when I started with Jesus and I started investigating with him further with the help of internet, and now there is so much on Facebook going on, and you know, there are so much indications that what he has been saying is really true. The thing is that nobody can explain the why. Nobody explains the mechanism. The expanding Earth theory is so logic, and you know, there is so much evidence that really the continents were together on a smaller Earth, and you see that the continents really fit better when you make the Earth like half a diameter smaller. How can you explain that? You know, and no, what is the problem with this theory that it's not accepted by the mainstream geologists? The big point is that nobody can explain the mechanism. So I don't blame Jesus Camara or Fredo Camara that they don't have a mechanism for it. They don't have an explanation, because nobody has.
Nobody has.
But that it happens, that is thanks to my own investigations further into it. I just can't avoid evidence like that. It must have been like that, you know. There must have been an enormous increase of mass on the Earth, you know. Only, of course, the time frame, if you talk about a smaller Earth where all the continents were together, that must have been in the geological time scale 200 million years ago.
Wow.
And, yeah, and then the continents start spreading, and then all the water in the oceans came there, and that's where we're now, 300 million years later. But where the Earth has been growing, and mainstream agrees in that, on that, is in the oceans. The oceans are spreading, and that's where we see all the growth. That's the newest mass that's mm-hmm. has been increasing the size of the Earth. Of course, mainstream says, yeah, but then it must be so that it's diving under the continents. And that's the subduction theory, you know. Mm-hmm. And they find really some subduction in some places, but the subduction they can measure, it's not enough to explain all the new mass that's been added to Earth.
Yeah, I have the same theory, that we just don't have the scientific capabilities to measure the subtle energy that is taking place on Earth. And I think that there's subtle energy that the Chinese have discussed, as well as the Hindus, in the human body that mm-hmm. we're just beginning to understand, and I think it all relates to our planet. So let's go on to the next period, the Urin Pacha, and what the style of stonework is with that period of time. What is that style of stonework?
Yeah, well, what it has in common, because there are different kinds of walls that fits into the Urin Pacha style, but what they have in common is that all the walls fit perfectly together. The stone blocks are there without any space between them. They can be cellular form, or they can be rectangular form, but normally they fit perfectly together, and normally not one block is the same size or the same form as the other. So that means that, well, the blocks were fitted together in such way that, the only conclusion that one can make is that they must have been soft in that moment. There are others that say, well, they must have had a very advanced kind of machining. I've been seeing that a lot, relating it to ancient aliens technology or something like that. I'm not saying there weren't any aliens in the past or there aren't aliens now. I really don't know. I never met one, so...
You haven't deciphered any writing or discovered an alien grave in your research.
No, I don't have. But also Kamara says, well, maybe humanity came from outside of us one time in the past, no? But the thing is that if an alien comes now to us, he will probably die immediately, because one needs to adapt here. One needs to be able to adapt to the climate, to the atmosphere, to the pressure, to gravity. So what Camara says, that there were bigger men, bigger skeletons, they could live longer because of the circumstances in the past. And also that means that they had all technologies to work in stone, and the stone was also different. The stone and how geological processes, of course, there must be something that we don't know, that it was different as what we learned in the geology classes.
So are you saying that there was a... in the second world, Urenpacha, you have detected some form of technology in shaping the stones? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, what one can detect, and that is something that I think it's very important, and that is where I want to go further with investigations. And it's a bit difficult to get this in mainstream circles, because what you see on those walls, and also on the Urenpacha style, you see it was treated with heat. It was treated with heat because it left a smooth layer, a vitrified layer, as we call it, on many parts of the stone. Not, you can't see it everywhere anymore because it must have been eroded away. During thousands of years, the small, very thin layer is away now. You can't see it anymore. But on many protected places, and also on the Urenpacha walls, you still can see those spots with vitrification, and you can see it in the walls of Cusco at night, for example, with the light of the streets. You can go to a cave, Urenpacha cave, and if you go inside with some light, you can shine on it, and then it reflects, and it's very obvious once you know how to look at it. And I was surprised that other investigators didn't see it, didn't know how to look, and it was really Jesus Camar who showed me how to do that. And once you start to see it that way, then you can recognize it in all other places, in all other sites where you have the Urenpacha and the Urenpacha stonework.
The thing that I find interesting, though, is the Urenpacha is this volcanic rock, and as you said, it seemed like they had some kind of technology which actually made rock, or it was in a volcanic raw state that they manipulated. And then you go, after that first world ends, Urenpacha is more of a technical stone, which is highly crafted, very well designed, and you have these intricate walls that you show in Cusco, and also in Sacsayhuaman, and other places. And it just seems like that's a technology period, this Urenpacha, don't you think? Or what is your thinking on that?
Yeah, but Camara relates it to the different circumstances, that the circumstances on Earth changed from very few gravity, very small gravity, to somewhat more gravity, and the scale of complete mountains of rock changed to smaller blocks. Very big blocks, but it were blocks, it were pieces, while in the Urenpacha it was made in the same rock, in the mountain. The second part, the second period, was Urenpacha, when they could make blocks of stone. And those blocks of stone were still like in a clay form, in a soft form. And then they were able to put them together, to put walls together. And in that moment, they applied the technology that must have been with heat. And with that heat, it seems that they could harden the rock so it would stay as they wanted. You know, and that's when you see the vitrification is especially on the borders, and you see also that the theory of soft stone is because in all those walls of Urenpacha time, you see that they were able to form the stone as they wanted. They were able to make the stone around the corner. Why would you make a corner in one piece of stone if you could just make one rectangular stone and fit it together with another rectangular stone like we do now? No, they just made a block around the corner.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy, and they did it in all those sites in Cusco and near to Cusco in Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuaman. And what you also see is that the perfect fit, there's not one place where there's not a perfect fit. It's always perfect. Why would it be so perfect? You know, if it was a technology of polishing and using some metal tools, there could have been a few pieces where it was not that perfect. No, it's always perfect.
Yes.
And that means that to make it perfect, it's very easy if at that moment the stone was soft. You just put a block, one block over the other, and the block above will sit down in the block below. Yeah?
Now, a majority of Cusco is Urinpacha, wouldn't you say? Or is it a combination? I don't think I've seen any examples that you've presented of Hanenpacha being in the city. But it looks like Urinpacha and some Urkinpacha are...
There is mainly, because they are buildings, there is mainly Urinpacha and Ukonpacha. That's the third period, that is the period of the Incas, when they were able to, to make very nice walls. Nothing bad about the Incas. They were very capable to make walls. But you see that it was on a smaller scale and it was less perfect. They were able to make nice walls, trying to imitate the Urinpacha type of walls, but it was with smaller stones and with metal tools and sometimes a bit more space between the stones. And,
okay.
There is no vitrification on those walls.
Before we go to the final world, Urinpacha, tell me what skeletal remains are found for Hanenpacha and Urinpacha. I think, you tell me, because I want you to tell me what you think they've discovered.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure about this, and I'm still trying to find evidences, and there is a lot of talking about the giants, and but it's mostly in the United States, I think. Real giants haven't been found. Gamar talks about several meters, like 8 meters or something like that, that there would have been. And he said, well, probably there aren't any remains about it, because they must have been, they must have had a skeleton that was very soft, like cartilage.
Oh,
so
interesting. Okay.
The cartilage, its skeletons, they would have been gone already.
Yeah.
That there won't be anything left. And why does he say that? That's not an excuse to say they're not there anymore. No, it's logic, because what happens if an astronaut goes to space? You know, in zero gravity, his bones turn more like cartilage.
Yeah, soft. Yeah.
It gets soft. Yeah. It gets softer, and well, NASA sees it as a problem, as a disease, but it's not. It's just a readaptation to another ambience, It's another place, and you have all the circumstances, and the body will adapt to it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Okay.
When the astronaut comes back to us, then his bones get strong again,
right?
Bit by bit. And that is one explanation. Then we have, of course, I'm not sure if you want to talk about the elongated skulls.
I do want to bring it up a little bit, because that's a previous of mine. Now,
what my take on it, and Kamara also has something to say about it.
Okay,
is that they might have been people that were. They're not that big, you know. They're not that big like the giants or something. There might have been a readaptation when there was this change from the Urinpacha time till the Ukonpacha time. So maybe they were the first people that had to readapt to the new circumstances. And I thought maybe they are from Urinpacha time, but I think Kamaya says no, they are like the readaptation. And it seems that the skulls have very dense bone. So it was like a reaction of the body to new circumstances where the density and the gravity was more intense, and the body had to readapt to those circumstances. And
okay.
The elongated skulls, you know, if a baby gets born, what is the last
the place, place of Fontanelle, the top of the
Fontanella. That's the last place in the body that is closed and that gets hard, where the bone gets hard. So if there is a longer period of growing, which would have been in the time of the Udanpacha and Ghanapacha, the body needed more time to grow. Everything was slower because of the less density, the less gravity. So they could form like elongated skulls. But the elongated skulls, there is a little doubt still with me that they might have been from Rinpoche time, but I think they are like a readaptation. And they're not only readaptation, there are several other special features of Peruvians that have like readaptations in the bodies. And Gamar is the expert on that, and he has more details about that. And,
okay.
And I would like him to come with all the details, so I leave this part off to him.
Gotcha.
Very interesting investigation, of course, about elongated skulls.
Well, it's always great to find skeletal remains from the people who would build Sacsayhuaman because of those megalithic bone monoliths that are that make up that wall.
Yeah.
But I think that kind of transcends to our next age, which is Ukanpacha, which is, I guess that would be, would you say 10,000 years and then to the present or up to the Inca time, right?
Yeah, that's the time from when there was the last change of orbit. According to Gamarra, it would have been like 25,000 or 30,000 years ago.
Okay.
So I have a little doubt there. And I think there might have even be a force change, and that was like 12,000 years ago. You know, there are a lot of people talking about that. For example, Graham Hancock says there was a big change 12,000 years ago.
Yes.
And there was like a big change in the geology and the sea level, etc., etc. And
right.
that might have been a force change that was maybe somewhat less serious. Not that big change, but there was a change, and there is also a lot of megafauna that died out from 12,000 years ago.
Right.
So that's another indication. The scale of life could be bigger from 12,000 years ago till longer ago, and from one moment to the other, they died out.
Well, this is what's curious to me is if I haven't been to Cusco yet. I'm hoping to come out this late spring or summer, early summer. But it seems to me that Sacsayhuaman's walls are more the Ukanpacha, the last phase, because they're not. I don't, unless you can tell me there is vitrification heat on those stones. They
yeah.
are very raw, and they're well fitted. They fit together perfectly, but there's
mm-hmm.
no refinement like the early Urinpacha period, where there's a vitrification. There is a. It's almost like they're a manufactured stone. They're so clean looking.
Yeah.
So what?
There are differences in style. Yes, there are.
So,
but
what is your theory on Sacsayhuaman and those megalithic walls that they put there? What is that a last period or is it a combination?
No. It's because of the size. It would have been maybe an earlier period than Ulanpacha time. Maybe there are Ghanapacha time, but there are pieces. And because they are very big blocks, so Gamarra says there might have been Ghanapacha pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So from Ghanapacha time, because of the enormous size, they're very big blocks. And that Ulanpacha time was with somewhat smaller blocks. And well, as I said, in the typical thing about the Ulanpacha blocks is that they fit together, but they can look smoother or they can look less smooth. But they always fit together, and you can always find vitrification on them. So those are the things they have in common.
Okay, so would you say that? Both the city of Cusco and Sacsayhuaman are all three worlds. So there's the early period, the Ghanapacha, Urinpacha, Ukanpacha, all merging into one, and they can all three examples can be found at both of those places. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Wow.
Yes, you can find the three examples. Well, inside the city of Cusco, there's not much Hanampacha. There is a place, for example, if we go up to Sacsayhuaman, just about above the center of the city, there is Hanampacha in a playground of a school, and nobody takes it seriously. It's not important. It's just there, and they are just rocks, but you see that Hanampacha style.
Mm.
There is a cave above Cusco that till in the time that we were filming, there was Gamara. They didn't even protect it. It was they left their litter there, and it was like a public toilet, and
it was horrible
inside. And we cleaned it up, and last year it was cleaned up by Bob and Ann from USOX, and they did a good job there also. It's now, happily enough, it's now protected, it's now officially protected, and it's now taken care of by the Cultural Institute of Cusco, so they now take it more serious. But if you go to my Facebook page, for example, I have the cover picture, how you call that, the picture, the big picture on the Facebook page.
Oh,
you see there,
right. Mm-hmm.
You see there a very big stone, just beside the road, above the city of Cusco, and that's a Hanampacha piece. It's very eroded, very old, but nobody knows what to think about it. And you know, you have so many examples around Cusco, not that much really in the center of the city, but around Cusco, just above it, just above the center, pieces of Hanampacha all around. And you have them in Sacsayhuaman and around Sacsayhuaman. The whole area of Sacsayhuaman is like 30, 40 kilometers, square kilometers. And it's literally all over the place.
If you're enjoying this program and have been listening to other Earth Ancient podcasts, I'd appreciate it if you would support our sponsor, Gaia. And Gaia is a streaming website that has first-class programs on ancient civilizations, pyramid culture, sacred geometry, and hundreds of special programs, special series on ancient wisdom, cultures that have left the earth, Atlantis. And then there's spirituality, wellness. Oh, I mean, there's this amazing programs. There's a whole series on NASA. And I really would appreciate it if you would support Gaia. And Gaia is offering Earth Ancient members a special offer for 99 cents for the first month. You can get full access to all these programs and many, many more, even the new programs. And to do that, go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients. That's www.gaia.com/Earth Ancients. And when you support Gaia, you support Earth Ancients. We need your support to keep developing the best program on the internet. All things ancient of the earth, all things present, and even into the future. Join us, join Gaia, support Earth Ancients. I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's a gigantic facility.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit. Okay so Urkan Pacha, which is the last phase, what's the example, rock example, the style of cutting? It's more loose, and you say that also kind of transitions into the early...
You see little dots on the stone. That means that they probably used hammer and sickle to work on a stone.
Okay, so they actually used implements, stone cutting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Metal tools.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. That would be 10,000 into the Inca period. And
from then until now, yes, it's a time that that we live in, the present orbit, the present gravity circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they needed to do it that way. They can work in on the scale that they were able to do in the former periods. And mm-hmm. what we can do now is to do something similar. You see that they work in Adobe. There is now the Adobe that's like clay. And they make houses of it in Cusco, the modern houses. Also the Incas, they used this Adobe for some constructions also. So that's something similar. You can compare it with that.
Did the Inca themselves and anything Gamara discovered or what you've discovered recognize the ancients before them?
Well, what Gamara says is that the spiritual worlds of the Incas, they are exactly what he calls those periods, the Hanan Pacha, the Uran Pacha, and the Ukon Pacha. And the Hanan Pacha literally means the heaven above. So it's above. It was the world of above, the world further towards the sun, heaven on earth. That's what means the term Hanan Pacha. And then there was another world that went down. We went down. We went further away from the sun. And that is when we were thrown out of paradise. And we went down, you know, the fallen angels. You can compare it with those type of terms. And then that is what happened when we went towards the Uran Pacha time. And then there was that third period that coincides with... when Kamaya says it was the time from the Tower of Babel and confusion of languages, that was another change, and people from one moment to the other had to learn to talk. According to Kamara, when it was Uran Pacha time and Hanan Pacha time, we didn't need to talk because of the whole earth was less dense and less gravity circumstances made it much easier to communicate with telepathy.
Oh, telepathy. Oh, mind to mind. Okay.
Mind to mind because of the less density. You know, we at present time to materialize our thoughts, we need a lot of time and a lot of concentration. And at that time, it was much easier to work with the mind and to even have maybe influence on the materials.
Okay.
And it was possible to have telepathy. And it's interesting that, you know, the capacities that we say that the gods had in the past were possible due to the circumstances in those times. And one of the things that most fascinates me about this whole theory is that it really explains things that at the moment we are researching, the why and how it was possible that they could do those things in the stone, and how it's possible that there were giants, and how it's possible they might have been living hundreds of years or thousands of years, and then you get explanations from this. And we don't need to go to ancient aliens. We don't need to invent them, you know. Nothing bad about them. Maybe they existed, but this really explains, and ancient aliens is okay. Yeah, you can invent all kinds of technologies that maybe those ancient aliens would have used, but no, it's not necessary if you use this theory.
I firmly believe that's the entire premise of Earth Ancients, is that mankind has developed his own technology through different ages, and that's, I firmly believe that, and I have a serious problem with the ancient alien theory. They just discount human, Earth humans, and everything that is fantastic or megalith or whatever is all related to ancient aliens, and I think that's...
Yeah, that's correct.
It's an excuse. It's an excuse. But on that note, I'm really curious, because in your studies, Jan, you have gone to Greece, and I think you've gone to Malta, I think you've gone to other places, and actually have chronicled this technology, Hanan Pacha, Uran Pacha, and Ukon Pacha, in other parts of the world. Why don't you give us a couple of examples of other ruins in other parts of the world that have at least one or two of those styles of stonework?
Yeah, well, for example, in Greece, I didn't go to Greece, but when I did a conference here in Holland, there was a guy that's, he works in stone, how do you call that?
Sorry. Oh, a masonry.
A masonry, yeah, he works in stone, he's an artist, No, he's an artist, so he makes sculptures or
sculpture,
something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he liked very much my documentary because I show a lot of stonework and very special stonework and, you know, with the technology that we don't understand. So he was fascinated by it. And then somewhat later, I think like 1 year, 1.5 year later, I got a message from him. And he said, oh, I went to Greece and I saw that there was Hanan Pacha there. And I said, really? I didn't know that. I didn't know there was Hanan Pacha in Greece. And he went to the big temple.
Parthenon. Wasn't it the Parthenon that I saw pictures of?
The Parthenon, yes, exactly.
I couldn't believe it.
It's above the city of Athens. And he went there and he took pictures. And he gave me the right to use them on my website. And it's very clear for me. I don't need to go there to know that it's Hanan Pacha because it's the same style. It's made in the rock. It's the rock of the mountain on which the Parthenon is made.
Which
it's
is
the base.
Fascinating.
It's the
it shows, it's, to me,
yes.
it's like the Maya, who cherished and sanctified their previous generations and previous ancestors,
mm-hmm.
and they built on top of their structures or around them, and what you're showing in this the Parthenon is that there's a good example of the Greeks building on top of or around an early civilization's structure.
Exactly,
yeah.
And then later, as I was investigating further. Then I saw that below, at the level of the where the hill starts, at the level of the city, mm-hmm. there are Ulan Pacha walls. And what they do all the time, they make Ulan Pacha walls around the Hanan Pacha mountains, around the Hanan Pacha structures, like they do in Machu Picchu. Mm. Like Sacsayhuaman is one very big wall that is around a very big rock that comes up from the city of Cusco, and around it there is a wall, and you know that Jesus Camara says that was the Tower of Babel. That's another subject, but you know, it's the same principle of a Hanan Pacha piece that was surrounded by Ulan Pacha walls. And it's fascinating. I saw in Bulgaria a few weeks ago, the other week on Facebook, a picture. And it was Hanan Pacha, and around it it had Hanan Pacha wall. Very small, but it has. It's obvious. It's something that is repeated on world level, and it's very interesting.
So where else have you found examples of these the three world structures? Is there any place else in Europe or?
Malta is a good example. You have the Hypogeum, and further above. The Hypogeum is like. An altar in a cave.
What city? What city is that?
It's a Hypogeum in Malta.
Malta. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's in Malta.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So if you go a bit further up, then you have around it, you have Ulan Pacha walls. Very big stones fitting perfectly together.
Okay.
Yeah. You have the same in the pyramid, the Great Pyramid of Egypt. You have the first rows of the stones of the pyramid are Ulan Pacha style, and inside there are also Ulan Pacha style, and they're above the Hanan Pacha mm-hmm. structure, which is the subterranean chamber. And
well, let me see
that repeated in other pyramids.
Let's discuss the Great Pyramid for a minute. So Hanan Pacha is the base or the foundation area, and then they built the actual pyramid itself, which is an Ulan Pacha. So if that's the case, then what you're saying is, based on your theory, that the pyramid is probably significantly older by 20,000 years than what Orthodox Egyptologists have said.
Yeah, I think it's much older, yes. Due also to the size and the scale, and you know that this whole theory of the Kamara says that all the big scale and perfectly fitting walls, they were from an old time period.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay,
so.
we're going to jump into one of my big interests, and the basis for, I believe, one of your books, which is The Vitrification.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a curiosity of mine. Now, I haven't seen the I've seen your photographs, but I haven't seen it up close and personal. What do you think is the cause of a finish like is found in these examples of vitrification? What is the technology behind it, and why would they do that? Why would they have that finish on there?
Yeah, well, the finish is caused by the application of heat. I'm not sure how they did it. Probably they used like metal sheets, or maybe they had to blow like we blow now glass, something like that. But it weren't like it's not a machine tool or something very big which they cut very precise stone. No, it was soft stone that was heated, and the heat left like a very thin layer of the stone, and at the same time the stone was hardened. It's like ceramics on steroids. I'm not sure if you can imagine
ceramics on steroids.
Ceramics on steroids, like
oh my god,
like a big, okay. A very big example of ceramics. We now make ceramics, but we put it on in an oven, and,
yeah.
And it's only small pieces.
Okay.
But at that time, everything could be done on a bigger scale, so they could do it on a very big scale. How exactly? It's very difficult to imagine how things were on this earth when gravity was much less and the density of all materials was must have been much less also, because they are complete other circumstances. It's like being on the moon and. Of course, with an atmosphere, no? Because we needed atmosphere. But
it's such a perfect technique because
yeah.
When they're forming these stones, and it looks like they're actually using a high heat to cut and shape the stone, and then
mm-hmm.
as it's fitted together with another stone, the
yeah.
finish is...
You must imagine that cutting was not the problem because the stone was soft. They just could form it like they want. That's also the reason that you see these strange knobs, and you also see that there's many times the Ulaanbaatar was that the lower part is like cushion formed, as if the mass of the stone is going outwards because it was going down due to the some gravity that they had in that time also, of course, some gravity there was, and that made the soft stone go out a bit, like forming cushion, giving it a cushion form. And also the strange knobs and all kind of strange forms that they could make in a stone. That for me, it must lead to only one conclusion, that the stone was soft on the moment of construction.
So that means that they had a technology where they could. Would you say the stone was in a molten state, or just a soft?
No.
State? No, it wasn't molten.
It was like it was clay-like. It was like big pieces of clay that they were able to shape, and then with some technology, and that was the heating technology, they must have heated the stone, and then the stone hardened, and it stayed as they wanted, and that also that same heating technology left the vitrified layer, which we have proof that there is this vitrified layer because. One needs to see it in person to believe it exists, because many people say, it must be a reflection, it must be nicely polished, and of course polishing can lead to very good results, but if you see it again and again and again, and you see it's applied on a very big scale, who's going to polish all those stones? They must have been crazy to do it. No, you won't do that, you know.
Yeah.
The Incas weren't crazy. They could use the time very well, and some investigators say the Incas must have had another concept of time. I don't believe that. No, as an agriculture engineer, I know they needed a lot of time for the agriculture because it was very labor intensive, and they had very nice terraces and a lot of crops that were growing, To tell me that they went polishing all those stones because they wanted to look good? No, I don't believe that.
Well, so as it, I mean, yeah, that's kind of crazy. But It seems to me that from an artist's perspective, the Urin Pacha style is of the most refined in look and appeal. It's just, it's like, it's a really manufactured stone style, and it's just, it's amazing. It's, to me, it's a technology at its best.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very, it's enough nowadays. We can do it that way. We should do it the same way with cement, you know?
Yeah.
And that's also why there isn't a theory that exists, and it's based mainly on the Egyptian stonework. It's called the geopolymer theory.
Right.
You must have heard about it. And it's a logical theory. I don't agree completely with it, because many times what they find is that they are natural stones. They are the same type of stones as they find in quarries, and only that it must have been in a soft state in some way.
Okay.
And that's a strange thing. We don't know how, we don't know why, and many don't agree with me because they say, well, it's natural stone, so how could it have been soft, you know? But it must have been soft, because there's no other way to form the stone as they did. It's really, if you see so many examples, you see so many knots, you see so many strange formed stones, and you see so much perfection between those stones that there is nothing that you can put between them, then it's obvious to think that it must have been soft when they made those walls. Because if you put one stone above the other, it will fit perfectly if it's like clay.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need nothing more. Just use soft stone and it's there. But they didn't use molds.
You don't think they used molds? You think it was actually crafted
individually? We talk about molding the stones and the use of molds, but not in the way that it's one standard mold.
Oh, a standard.
Or it's not. Okay. It's not one exactly the same size mold. No. But they could mold the stone, form the stone as they wanted, and maybe use a piece of metal to cut the stone and to make forms into the stone. But it's not one piece that is exactly the same as all the other pieces, as we would have now, like we do our buildings now.
I can see why you go back every year, or more than once a year, back to that part.
I would prefer to go more times a year, but it's a bit difficult.
Now, your wife is from Cusco, correct?
Yes, my wife is from Cusco.
Okay, so you actually, you married someone from that area, so maybe you have to go back because of the parents, right?
Yeah, also, yes. The family,
okay.
Yes.
Well, that's a good excuse to go back.
Yes, it is. Yeah, well, I like to go back always, yes. It's great to be there, and I had a great time, and I lived there, and it's always great to go back there.
Fantastic. We have just a little more time. I want to ask you about your theory on orthodox science. You say in your recent work that there's a problem with orthodox science in viewing ancient ruins and megaliths. You call it a reductionistic science. Can you explain what you mean by that?
The reductionistic science is science that's very common to lose oneself in this kind of research, because we are used to do that, you know. All kinds of disciplines within science, they go to the details, and in the details there's much to do, there's much to see, and much to improve. If we see, for example, if I go to my own science, that's agricultural science,
right.
Well, they're finding other pesticides, and they're finding other ways of fighting the plagues and they find other
methods
like better fertilizers or etc. but sometimes I lose out of sight that there are also other components within the whole picture, and if you go to the details, there is a risk of losing out of sight the whole picture. And if you go only to the details in this kind of research, I saw during my own studies that they were industrializing the agriculture at my university, and it was also good to see social and ecological effects of what we were doing there. So I started to be interested in ecological agriculture, because they take it as a whole and
holistic, yeah, holistic approach.
The holistic approach, and,
yeah.
And there are also other approaches like multidiscipline approach and things like that. It's of course now more talked about, but at that time that I was studying, it was just starting that these kind of approaches were getting more popular. And I see it, for example, in archaeology, you can make comparisons. Also in medicines, you know, the modern medicine investigations, they go to medicines and they don't see the body as a whole or humanity as a whole, because
yes.
They only try to find one cure with a medicine, while there are many kinds of cures, and we need to see other causes of a disease. If you have a disease, you want to cure it with a medicine, it can come back, because maybe the cause is psychologic, or
yes.
Maybe the cause is something else. And you know, if you do this kind of research, there is a risk of losing out of sight other factors and other.
I agree with you, because I think there's a multi-
I don't say we don't have to do reductionistic investigations, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean the thing is that the holistic approach to archaeology, which is what my biggest issues have been, is that some of the more recent discoveries have been made by engineers in the Mayans, engineers like Chris Dunn in Egypt, and discovering that the stonework was actually machined with power tools or some form of technology, and in the Yucatan, engineers like Okan have discovered that they were using highly sophisticated cements, and
mm-hmm.
they were using water purification systems that no one knew about, and the archaeologists never mentioned this. In fact, they actually think that the Mayans were lucky with their technology, and that they inherited, or excuse me, they didn't inherit, that they were just, you know, not really a sophisticated people. And who are left now, actually, there's a tradition, an oral tradition that they just don't even pay, the Orthodox Mayans don't even pay attention to, which
mm-hmm.
drives me nuts. So I think that's what you mean by the reductionistic science.
Well, what is important, if you do reductionistic science, it is important to realize yourself what your assumptions are. That was the word I was looking for, assumptions.
Yes.
If you make an assumption, and that's why you go into the details. But if your assumptions are wrong, then if you do reductionistic science, you're going on the wrong track.
Yeah.
You're going completely wrong, because one assumption is wrong, your whole result will be wrong. And that's what's happening, for example, in archaeology. If they make an assumption, I always make an example with the vitrification. Nobody from archaeologists has seen it. You know, they always say, well, they must have been polishing because it looks polished. But if you don't investigate it, that is where I go to the reductionistic science, because I have another assumption and I want to know what is the composition of the layer. You know, and I found with one sample, I found that it has a lot more silicon, so it's very probable that it has been heated, because the stone, the rest of the stone is a limestone. So if you have a very high concentration of silicon in the layer, it has a complete other composition than the rest of the layer of the stone. Which means that at that point I go to reductionistic science because my assumption is that they used heat. While the archaeologists, they don't even investigate it, because their assumption is that they must have been polishing. So you understand.
They got out,
it's not even investigated, because they make assumptions that it's all from the Incas.
Yeah.
And the Incas did the best work at the last of their the period of when they were there the last time, just when the Spanish came in, they must have been doing their best work, because that's like their evolution, you know, the evolution of the process that makes it from simple to better.
Yeah.
While it's been the other way around. If you say it's the other way around, they come to other conclusions and you will investigate differently. So they lose out of sight, for example, they lose out of sight that there are comparisons to be made in the stonework between different parts of the world. But if you say, well, the Spanish discovered the Americas, so there wasn't any contact before that, then, of course, we are already wrong.
Yeah. That's a big one that a lot of people have a problem with. Well,
yeah.
Listen, Jan, this has been a great, great interview. I really have... You've really opened my eyes up to a lot of your work. Do you have any new books or any tapes you're working on you'd like to talk about? And before we end our interview, you can also provide us with any upcoming tours you're doing to Cusco
So that was Jan Peter DeJong, and fascinating material. I am going to post some photographs of his work, his discoveries, and if you actually look at those photographs, and if you've been to Peru, Machu Picchu being the most well-known Peruvian ruin, pre-Inca ruin, you can begin to see these three worlds, these three periods of time that he's speaking of, the oldest being the Hana Pacha, which is the volcanic style of rock, which is fascinating to me, because if you he actually believes that it was in a clay form, which doesn't really, you know, explain a lot about how it became in clay form. One of his associates says that it was some kind of a chemical reaction that was created in there, rather than being in a molten state, which is kind of mind blowing. Because when you look at the stonework of that early period, Hana Pacha, it looks like clay. It looks like it's hardened clay. So, how do you create rock in that format? I mean, it's like something that was made in a chemist's lab, a rock that was grown in a chemist's lab. And then we go to the second period, which is the Urin Pacha, which I find just fascinating. It's the most aesthetically pleasing stonework, where the high heat is applied to the stone, which is still, according to Jan, in a clay-like state. But the finish, the highly polished finish, which is some heat, is the vitrification that he speaks about. And then we conclude with the final period, with the Urin Pacha being the basic stonework that's cut, raw rocks and stones that are chiseled away, and maybe a little bit of technology has been left. And they're able to position the rocks for walls and some buildings, but it's not even close to the first two periods, Hanan Pacha and Urin Pacha. It's more of grabbing boulders and stacking them in a nice position. And you can really see the difference when you're in Peru in some of these pre-Inca locations. Actually, pre-Inca to Inca is what Jan tells us. So Jan has actually emailed me a whole series of photographs that I will post on the Facebook page, which highlight these amazing stoneworks in the various periods. So that's it for this show. Thanks all to you. Keep an eye on Facebook and keep an eye on what's coming up. I believe I'll have a confirmation on our next guest very soon, so stay tuned. Thank you. And